This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. If you need help bringing out the best in your pet, give us a call right now at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls today, we have another special topic to share. Patricia?
We do. You know, when we turn on the television and watch all those great nature shows that most of our listeners, I'm sure, love to watch like you and I do, PBS, Animal Planet, how often do we see features on the big cats, the cheetahs and the lions of Africa and tigers in India? Yeah, they're all over the place. But today, we're going to feature a great American cat, a cat who just doesn't get enough respect, in my view, the cougar.
Well, that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I think so. They're great animals.
You know, also a little later on, we'll talk to a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel about a special dog named Lava who he found while on his tour of duty in Iraq, and we'll hear about all that he went through to bring Lava back with him to the U.S. It was a lot. But before we get to that, we do have some callers waiting to talk to us, so let's go to those phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
I'm so glad you guys are having me on the show. This is Kristen Nelson in Anchorage, Alaska.
Kristen, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I read The Other End of the Leash before I got my dog, and so now I have a very well-socialized 20-month-old Belgian sheepdog boy.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Yeah, he started reacting to overly rowdy dogs or dogs that he was that he thought were really large a couple months ago, and I've been counter-conditioning him and training him, and he's doing really well.
Good for you.
Super.
Yeah, but I have a couple questions. Most of the puppy books seem to stop when your dog hits 18 months old, acting like, oh, suddenly they're mature adults.
Right.
And that obviously wasn't the case for me. And so I was kind of wondering what typical changes I can look for in dogs that are hitting that age, because I'm wondering what else might be around the corner.
Oh, it's a great question. It's a really good question. And I think you're right. There's a kind of a gap. Often a lot of the books talk about how to get started.
Yeah.
And then they leave you. And then there you are. And one of the things we know, and I'm sure you're noticing, is that dogs have an adolescent period very much like humans do. And I say very much like humans in that their behavior tends to be relatively labile. It's as though they're trying on, I don't mean consciously necessarily, but it's as though they're trying on, I'm going to be like this today. And then tomorrow I'm going to be like this.
Sort of like your kids.
Sort of like your 13-year-old girl and your 15-year-old boy. So one is often at this age, about a year and a half, you see changes in behavior. You'll see a dog, like I said, sort of acting in a way that you'd never seen before, and then the next day he'll act differently. That's relatively normal. One of what you need to do, your reaction needs to be steady as she goes. You need to be the stabilizing force and not be too distressed when this puppy who's been really good and obedient has been doing really well, and you start to feel about a year and a half like,
him trained.
Okay, man, you know, I worked really hard. It's been a long year and a half, but and then it sort of seems to start falling apart. And that's often true somewhere between 8 months or so and a year and a half. And you need to just hang in there, go backwards when you need to. That's just fine. Not be too distressed about it. Keep remembering your goal. And the most important thing to remember with a dog this age is that dogs are not emotionally mature until they're about 3.
That's the other thing is his guarding instincts are kicking in, so I'm getting all that going on too.
And what do you mean when you say guarding instincts?
Well, he's becoming more concerned. If I was home ill and somebody and the cleaning lady let herself into the house, and before that would have been okay when he was a year old, but now he was very concerned because that wasn't normal to him.
And this is the time then to jump right in. I want you to do more counter conditioning. So for 6 months, everybody who walks in that door comes through showering treats or balls or whatever your dog really, really loves should be predicted by the doorbell or by a knock on the door. And I would do this hard and heavy. Well, that sounds sort of grim. I don't know. I would do this intensely but joyfully for 6 months or so.
And give that a try and see how that works.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks, Kristen. Thanks for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Hello there. You're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Catherine from Boise, Idaho.
Hi, Catherine. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm actually calling on behalf of my parents. They have two yellow labs, and my sister, within the past year, got a Yorkie Maltese mix that stays at the house and lives with my parents. So now they have two large dogs and one very small dog. And this small dog, his name is Henry, he's begun probably within the past half year or so to bark incessantly. All the time. He barks at anything that moves. He barks when nothing moves. My mom says, you know, he just barks because he's alive.
and that's a problem.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's a problem for people trying to live in the house. So they found a shock collar that was, you know, small enough, and they made sure that the size of the shock wouldn't, you know, kill him, and put it on him. And it seemed to be working all right, except for the fact that because they have three dogs, whenever the other two dogs would bark, it would also shock him.
Ow.
So that lasted for maybe a day, and my mom said, this is ridiculous. This isn't okay, because he was being punished for something he didn't do.
Right.
So at this point, they don't really know what to do, and you know, he's still barking all the time, so I was looking for some advice.
Yeah, boy, can I understand why. Some people are more sound sensitive than others, and I'm pretty high on the scale. I don't have a lot of incessant barking tolerance myself. So I think a lot of our listeners are very sympathetic to you. So first of all, yay for your mom for getting rid of the collar. That is exactly one of the problems. And we know there's lots of good psychological research out there that shows that animals who get especially shocked, punished in some way, for something they have no control over, this is the route to increased stress and anxiety, to what's called an overly efficient amygdalar pathway, which basically is what PTSD is.
It drives me nuts. I know.
Yeah, yeah. If you can't predict, if you have no control over it, it's really crazy making. And so yay for your mom for taking it off. Given that the dog barks already, I would put barking on cue. I've talked about this before. People are nodding out there going, yep, yep. I knew she was going to say that. Because if you have a dog who already is barking incessantly, you put it on cue and you say, bark, bark, good dog. You give the dog a treat. Now, when you teach a dog to do something on cue, you increase the frequency of the behavior. But if he's barking incessantly, what's the problem, right? So you put it on cue, bark, bark, good boy, treat, bark, bark, good boy, treat. That actually makes it easier, ironically, to teach the dog to stop barking to another cue. So
okay.
You say, bark, bark, good dog, treat, and then you say, enough. And you say it just like that. Enough. Larry's going to...
Enough.
Yes, perfect. See how our voices dropped off at the end? One, two, three. Here we go, Larry and I together.
Enough.
Larry's such a good... He just takes cues so well. So your
She's
voice
giving
is,
me treats, too.
Yes, right. I'm feeding him lobster as we speak. So your voice is going to drop off. It's relatively low. It's not yelled. It's really important it's not yelled. Otherwise, it sounds like you're barking, too, and barking's contagious. You say enough, and you put the treat. Don't give it to the dog, but put the treat right next to the dog's nose, no more than a half an inch away. And the dog, most dogs, 99% of them are like, there's food, right? I'm not going to bark now because I'm about to eat something. And so he's not, you say enough, you put the treat right by his nose, he's not barking, you say good boy, good boy, good boy, then you give him the treat. And then gradually expect him to not bark for longer and longer periods of time. So you teach him to bark on cue, bark, bark, good boy, enough, good boy. And then keep him busy doing other things, teach him tricks, just get a mind off barking.
I have another solution
yes,
to this
Dr.
problem.
Mueller.
Yes, we've received plenty of pet tips from listeners who've had dogs that like to bark a lot. And I can't claim this solution as my own. Melissa in Fayetteville, Arkansas, wrote in to tell us that she has two large dogs that sleep inside at night. And for a long time, they'd start barking at about 3 and 5 in the morning.
A little too early.
And she goes on to say, for a long time, the only way to get them to stop barking was if we got out of bed and let them outside. One night, I came up with the idea of leaving National Public Radio playing softly in the room where they slept. I kid you not, the first night they slept without waking.
I love it.
In fact, I could hardly rouse them in the next morning. I eventually started to experiment by leaving on a local rock station. The barking started again. After switching back to NPR for a week, I tried leaving the radio off altogether, and as you can guess, the barking woke us up in the middle of the night. So now we all sleep soundly as long as National Public Radio is playing on the radio, we've created more NPR junkies in the family.
And we are sending a check to you in return mail for the advertising for public radio. This is a great idea. And you know what I particularly love about this listener is she did just what you ought to do. She experimented. She tried the radio, and it seemed to work. But you know, it could have just been a coincidence.
Yeah.
But then she switched, tried a different radio station. And by the way, there is some suggestions that certain kinds of music does indeed stimulate dogs rather than soothe them. And you would guess that rock music would be one of those, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that didn't seem to work, but then she tried it without it, and then she went back to it. She did exactly the kind of experimental treatment design that you should do. So good for her. It's a great idea.
So, Catherine, maybe that'll help too. If the dog keeps barking, turn on NPR.
Might be a little trickier with an incessant barking during the day, but you know,
you never
can't
know.
Hurt but to try.
And thanks a lot for calling. By the way, how do people send us their pet tips?
We love to get your pet tips, and some of them are really good, like you just heard. Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at a big cat special to North America, the cougar, and we'll find out where these creatures live and what to do if you ever have a chance to encounter one of them in the wild. That's coming up after this short break. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7445.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Time for this week's topic, and Tricia, you'd like to take a moment to highlight an American cat that you say gets no respect.
You know, it's true. Most of the nature shows that we see are of African cats, like lions and cheetahs. Great stuff. I love it. But it focuses on African animals, maybe tigers in India. But you know, we have some incredible cats, some big ones here in America that deserve, I just think they deserve more attention.
Like the cougar.
The cougar is a perfect example. You know, this is big cat. It's known as a puma, sometimes a mountain lion. Did you know there are actually over 40 different names, names for this animal, including panther, catamount, and my absolute favorite, the mountain screamer. Love that. These are big cats, Larry. They're about the size of leopards. They weigh about 150, 200 pounds. That's a big kitty.
That's big.
They're gorgeous. They're tawny color. They have white muzzles and chins, and they are amazing athletes. They're very similar to leopards. They can run incredibly fast. They can run 43 miles an hour. They can jump 20 feet from a stand. Oh. There's even a credible report of a cougar jumping 12 feet up into a tree with a full-grown deer in his or her jaws. And they can kill and drag prey as much as 7 times their size. That's an amazing animal.
You know, I guess it's easy for us here in the Midwest, or maybe those out on the East Coast, to forget that we have a native wildcat here in America. Where can we find most cougars now?
Well, it's true that most of them are in the West. It's estimated right now that there are about 30,000 or so of them, mostly in the West. The good news is that the population right now, it's relatively stable. They were almost hunted to extinction. This is one of the good news, good conservation pieces of news that we have. Right now, the highest concentration of cougars in one small area seems to be on Vancouver Island, which is a pretty small island, by the way. So you're probably not going to see it, but you might see tracks. And in Los Padres National Forest in Northern California.
There have been a lot of news reports of attacks on humans, even a book about it, some fatal, mostly because we're invading their habitats. You know, it's not pleasant to think about, but what should you do if a cougar does attack you look like he's going to attack you?
Yeah, or look like it's going to. I mean, what is the chance of this happening? But, you know, the fact of the matter is it does happen. And if you just happen to be out hiking in Colorado or Northern California and you do see a cougar, here's the most important thing you need to know. Unlike a bear, where you're taught to be very quiet and maybe even go limp if you're attacked, this is the cougar is a predator. It's possible to sometimes to successfully fight off. You don't want to run away from it. That's the last thing you want to do. You are not going to outrun an animal that can run 43 miles an hour. You're going to trigger its chase and predatory instinct. What you can do is you turn to gather all your courage together. Turn and face this animal head on, intense eye contact, look right at it in a really threatening way, and shout low and loud, and make your body look as big as you can. Raise your arms, flap your jacket. That can be really effective. Take any action that makes you look large and menacing. If you can, if you have time, grab a stick. That can make you look bigger, too. You can, you know, beat it off if it starts coming towards you. The bottom line, is, speaking scientifically and precisely, is just fight like crazy. People have defended themselves successfully.
Well, it sounds like cougars are pretty territorial, just like our house cats are, as a matter of fact. So we should watch out if we find ourselves on their turf, I guess is the best advice.
They are. You know, a lot of their behavior is indeed very much like our house cats, and we should all be thankful that our cats do not run 150 to 200 pounds. And it's just, the cougar is just such a good example that we have a range of amazing cats in this country that, as I said, we just don't give them enough respect. We have lynx, we have bobcats. So if you're looking for a project for your kids, for example, and you want to do a little educational nature work, do a project on learning about our Native American cats because they're pretty awesome.
And if you find yourself in the wild with a cougar staring at you and you use the tips that Patricia has just given to save your life.
Yes, I'm all ears.
Please call in and let us know.
Oh, we would. Yeah,
we want to know. And I'm sure the calls will be flooding in.
I hope not, in a way.
No. We've got some other calls flooding in, as a matter of fact, at 1-800-462-7413. And we do have another caller online, so let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Arnie in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hi, Arnie. Thanks for calling.
I've got a problem. I have Misty is a 2-year-old female, yellow lab, and I obtained Misty from the SPCA on December 26. Misty would remain on her bed all day, too fearful even to eat if I was present in the room.
Aww.
Now, if a female visits, she's happy. She loves to lick them. But with me, she sulks a lot.
Aww.
She does walk with me, but as soon as we get home, she bolts inside the door to her bed.
Aww.
And she enjoys the walk. Now, how can I get her to accept me and be happy and stop his bolting?
This is really tough.
Yeah, this is a sad story. Poor Misty and poor you. You know, here you've been kind, wonderful man.
Nice guy.
Nice guy. You know, you should have a dog all over you. The bottom line is not what you're going to want to hear, but I'm going to blurt it out because I'm getting old and I don't know what else to do anymore. The simplest solution, the quickest solution is to rehome the dog and to home the dog with a female. Now, we have no idea why Misty is like this. It is indeed possible, as many people would think, that she had a negative experience with a man. But, you know, it's just as likely, maybe even more likely, that she grew up with women and never, ever was around a man. So she literally was not socialized. So to her, you're like an alien species. And she went through this critical period of socialization never having met a man. That's why this period is so important, where dogs meet everybody who's going to be part of their social framework. And maybe she grew up in a backyard, hardly ever getting out anywhere, and grew up with one woman or a bunch of women. So one solution that I want you to think about seriously is acknowledging that you rescued Misty and that your responsibility to Misty is to find her the best possible home. And if you decide you're not it, that's okay. It doesn't mean you're betraying her. It doesn't mean that you're doing anything except creating the life that she needs for her and giving her a great gift. So that's one thing I want you to seriously consider. If that is just not an option for you, then you're going to need to be very, very patient. I would first of all figure out what Misty loves and use that to try and condition her such that you put very little pressure on her. You let her make her own choices. Say, I don't know if she loves food. Some dogs who are that shy and shut down, they have enough cortisol in their body that it suppresses appetite. So I don't know if she'll take – will she take great treats from you?
I bake my own treats, and she loves them.
Good.
Now, little by little, she is beginning to eat if I'm in the room.
Okay.
And the more I walk her, she really enjoys the walk. I've been doing it twice a day now.
Good.
So she's beginning to improve.
It's really slow. It might take up to a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it might. And that's okay. If it's okay with you,
it's okay
what
with
I
me,
would do
she's a
is,
loving
if,
dog.
Is if she loves the walks most, then what I would do is I would take her on itty bitty walks 8 times a day, 6 times a day, 4 times a day, whatever you can, so that when you walk into the room, she learns to associate that with something she loves, which is the walk. So a lot of patience and a lot of good operant conditioning, and I think you're going to be walking a whole lot.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it, Arnie. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Jenny, and I'm calling from Alexandria, Virginia.
Hello, Jenny. What can we do for you?
We have a dog named Malcolm. He's a flat coat retriever mix.
Sure.
We adopted him from a rescue shelter about a week and a half ago. Very sweet dog, super demeanor, wonderful with our two children, ages 4 and 8. Well, he is crazy over squirrels in the backyard, and he will chase them, and even on a walk, if he sees a squirrel, the only time he pulls is if he sees a squirrel that he wants to hunt it. I'm thinking that. And what he does when we call him inside is he'll come to the door, and then as he gets to the back door, he runs back to the yard.
Sure.
As if he, first it was kind of cute, but now we're like, okay, this is really disobedient because he knows we want him to come inside.
Right.
Trying to figure out exactly what to do as far as training with him to let him know when
sure.
he needs to come inside.
Okay. So there are two issues, really. One is calling him in from the backyard when he's highly distracted, and obviously squirrels are the...
the big
graduate school of distraction. The other is what to do when he sees a squirrel inside or when you're on a walk. So let me address the first one. First, you had, I think you said, if I got it right, Larry, did I get it right? They've had the dog for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the good news in that 2 weeks is nothing.
Right.
I mean, what you're asking your dog to do is truly a PhD. It could take you a year to get your dog to respond to that. But you can do it. So one, you're going to prevent it when it's a problem. So say you have to go to work and you let the dog out into the yard right beforehand and he's chasing a squirrel, but you got to go because you're going to be late. So don't get in that situation. If you're in that situation, put him out with a really long line.
Mm-hmm.
And the smartest dog in the world never seems to get that they need to keep the end of the line away from you. They keep their body away from you, but they don't keep the end of the line away from you. So put him out on a 10-foot long, really light, simple line. Make sure he can't get it caught up in something and hurt himself. And so when you call him to the door, what you're going to do is sometimes you're going to take the end of that line and you're not going to look right at him and stare at him because that can keep him away from you. You're going to turn a little sideways and you're going to squat down. You're going to take the end of the line and you're going to call his name and you're going to call him to come. And you're going to have a great treat in your hand or a ball, something maybe a little stuffed fake squirrel. And you're going to call him into the house and you're going to help a little bit with a leash if you have to. And then you're going to give him a reinforcement, some kind of reward for when he comes inside, something he really loves. And then you know what you're going to do if you have time? You're going to let him go back outside again. So he doesn't think every time you call him to come.
Oh, it's curtains.
Exactly. So, you know, what he'll learn is he will become conditioned that when she calls come, fun is over. I hate it when she makes that noise. So what you're going to do is you're going to make it fun. You're going to make him happy he came in, and then part of the time you're going to let him right back out again. So that's one thing you're going to do. Meanwhile, you're going to work on teaching him to come when you call, which you have to teach like a circus trick. Dogs don't do it automatically. Easily could take you a year.
Take a little time,
yep.
But it will be well worth the effort. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll hear the story of a dog named Lava who was abandoned in Fallujah and adopted by an American soldier. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers online archives of the show, pet tips contributed by other listeners, and a complete list of guests featured on the program. Our website is callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Also, the radio store provides a selection of books and training guides featuring advice to deal with multi-dog households and leaving pets home alone. Information and ordering at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week we welcome Jay Koppelman to the program. Jay is a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel and the author of From Baghdad with Love, A Marine, the War, and a Dog Named Lava. Jay, welcome to the program. Tell us about the first time you met Lava.
The first time I met Lava was actually in Fallujah in November 2004 during the Battle of Fallujah, and he'd been found by a group of Marines from Hawaii, ironically enough called the Lava Dogs. And when I came up to their command post, they had taken over a house they'd found that he was just abandoned in, and coming off a patrol, he was there in the house with them and came charging across the floor at me, you know, like somebody had rolled a grenade across the floor. And that was my first experience meeting him.
What did it mean to you to have someone like Lava around while you were in Iraq?
Well, Lava actually kind of became everybody's puppy and companion. And I had very little contact with him relative to the other folks who were caring for him during my tour in Iraq. What he did come to represent, though, was a sense of normalcy, and I think that he gave people a reason not so much to live, but to make sure that he lived and to make sure that he got home, because he symbolized, I think, the hope that we had for the greater Iraq.
And it was fun to have him around and nice to have him around, but it was difficult to have him around as well, as you write about in your book. How difficult was it to have him around?
Well, it was fun and it was nice, but you're correct that it certainly was difficult. You know, there are regulations against keeping pets and mascots in a combat zone, and there are some good reasons for those regulations. So it becomes a little bit of a razor's edge that you have to walk, keeping him there, making sure he's not seen, but by the same token, not allowing him to distract from the mission at hand, because you certainly don't want to put anybody's life in danger over a puppy dog.
Jay, do you think that the military's policy that states that you can't have pets on base, I guess you said that's General Order 1A, do you think that policy should be reconsidered?
I certainly think that there are aspects of that policy that can be reconsidered, and there may be situations when it's more or less appropriate to enforce the policy. Remember that it's not just put in place willy-nilly. There are good reasons for that. You know, a lot of the wild animals that we saw there do carry diseases. There were starving dogs in Fallujah when we got there, large animals that we're feeding on bodies, and it's probably pretty difficult for something with an IQ of 70 to discern sleeping from dead, and I certainly wouldn't want to have that as my wake-up call. So there are good reasons, not the least of which would be that a dog could give away your position at an inopportune time. That said, there are also good reasons for having the dogs around, because they do provide really terrific morale. And if it's a non-combat situation and you could somehow certify that the dog is free of zoonotic diseases, then I think it would be okay to relax the regulations a bit.
And while there are many, many dogs in Iraq, we were bringing a few of our own over as well to Iraq, and they were called bomb-sniffing dogs, I guess you might be the term for it. I was fascinated by that part of your book, how the military dogs are trained to sniff out explosives and how do they react when they find evidence of one. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. There is an entire school for military canine handlers that's run by the Air Force. But Lava actually came home with a shipment of these working dogs. In the military, we call them military working dogs, MWDs. And the dogs that he flew home with were actually from a private kennel in Indiana that trains these dogs for that type of detection work, but also for protection. And it's a very intense job that these dogs do. Their olfactory senses are thousands of times more developed than ours. So the work is very intense for them. It's very demanding, and they get tired and worn out, and they need a break just as any human would. So it's a great program. The dogs are treated very, very well, believe me, probably better than we were during our stay in Iraq.
That's nice to hear. After all the reports of the dogs being abandoned in Vietnam, it sounds like the military has really turned that policy around.
Yeah, completely turned the policy around to the point of saying, okay, when a dog's career is over, he is up for adoption or she is up for adoption if the dog is deemed, you know, that it can be socialized. Sometimes they just can't. Sometimes the work is just too much for them, and then they have to be humanely destroyed. But in most cases, they are adoptable, and they can either go and live with the handler and his family, or they're adopted out to another family somewhere else.
Well, you were taking care of Lava a lot yourself, and maybe you could talk some more about how you managed to take care of Lava while also doing your duty as a military officer.
He ended up living on Camp Fallujah, which was the Marine base outside the city. And the Marines there who cared for him were able to do so strictly on the base until he got to be a little bit too big to really keep away from all the prying eyes for any longer, at which point during one of their regular runs to Baghdad, they were able to take him and drop him off with Ann Garrels from National Public Radio, who kept him at her house there. And she had some help in taking care of him, as I relate in my book. But it was a large cooperative effort. I depended on other people primarily to take care of Lava. I was then reassigned a week after getting back to Camp Fallujah. I got sent away for 6 weeks, then came back for 5 days, and then sent away again for another 6 weeks. So I really had very little time myself around Lava, and really only then on the base at Camp Fallujah. So for me, it wasn't an interference. I did spend some time helping to coordinate his escape, as it were, but really I didn't have any personal interaction with him, or very little.
It sounds like a lot of people were involved in this rescue effort, helping getting Lava out of Iraq into the States. Why do you think that they were willing to work so hard for this one individual dog?
Yeah, I think that people were willing to do that because it helped them look inward a little bit, recognize their humanity, have that introspection a bit, and make sure, just kind of do a check that their humanity was still intact in a situation that was certainly not the norm. And in many instances, psyche damaging for some people, physically damaging for other people. And I think that they felt that it was important to save something out of the whole situation, and Lava represented that for them.
And I think to some extent the problem was compounded by the sort of the normal relationship that people have with dogs, Iraqi people have with dogs in Iraq. And they're not always considered pets over there, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that's the case pretty much in the entire Middle East. Most Muslims believe that dogs are dirty. In the Middle East, dogs are not kept as pets. And so there are you know, any number of animals just running around loose in the streets. There's not any kind of sterilization program really on a wholesale basis there. And so you have a large overpopulation problem in not just Iraq, but most of the Middle East.
And yet Ann Garrels, who was a friend of yours as well, was able to convince an Iraqi to take care of Lava for a while, and she had to do a little talking to be able to accomplish that.
Right. The gentleman who mostly cared for Lava was actually, he's actually not Iraqi. I'd rather not say his nationality, though, because his family is still in Baghdad. But, you know, he didn't like dogs to begin with, but and Lava could certainly be surly, even as a puppy. So it took a bit of warming up for Sam to come around, but he eventually actually became very attached to Lava and did things to risk his life to make sure that Lava had food and ultimately the paperwork that he needed to get out of Iraq.
So after all these efforts, Lava finally made it through the work of all these people. I know it took months and months. How's he doing? How is he adapting to life in the U.S.?
He's doing great now. I think there were some adjustments initially, and he still, for no reason at all, can sit there in the living room in our house and just start his ruin and a little bit of barking and growling, and you don't know what it is that's triggering it. He's very protective, especially when he's in the car. So, you know, he may still have some issues, but I think he's doing just fine and having a good time.
And living well with your other dog. That was kind of a nice ending to your book there, how Lava in some ways helped you find yourself a partner.
He certainly did. We were at the park where I take him to play, and there were, you know, several dogs running around that particular September evening, and there was one child there who was really just completely engaged with the dogs and running and playing with them. And I think Lava decided, well, this must just be another one of us, and nipped at him the way he would with another dog. And a woman yelled at me that my dog had bit her child. And I was concerned, of course. And so I asked, well, does he have any diseases? And so about
the child,
I guess. Yeah, of course. No, I knew Lava was clean. So a few weeks later, I did ask her out on a date, and we got married last June and had a baby in January.
That is not your typical first date. I don't advise that in general as a good way to pick up women, although the dog is good, but the nipping of the child.
Well, it was a great way to end your book, and Jay, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you. Jay Koppelman is the author of From Baghdad with Love, A Marine, The War, and A Dog Named Lava. And he joined us today from the studios of KPBS in San Diego. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Jay's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. If you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of From Baghdad with Love by Jake Koppelman. And here's today's question. Adult cougars are solitary animals that live and hunt alone. They're highly territorial and will mark their territory with urine or scratch markings. Male cougars may breed with several different females. And when they breed, How many cougar kittens are born in the average litter? I don't know the answer to that. If you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413 and then check out our website in about a week to find out the answer. We'll have it posted at callingallpets.org. And now we are ready to take some more calls. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Matt. I'm living in Anchorage, Alaska.
Matt, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I recently moved in with my girlfriend. It's actually about a year ago. And we both have older cats that we had taken in as strays. And in the time that we've had them, they've both essentially set up their own territories in the house. And this comes most to a head in terms of litter box usage.
Ooh.
Because the male cat lives in pretty much the main living area of our house, and the female cat takes almost everywhere else. So he refuses to use a litter box if it's anywhere other than in a hall closet in one of our main living spaces. So I was wondering if you can think of any way to coax him to accept using a litter box outside of his range and hopefully downstairs somewhere where it's possibly out of the way of our nose shot, essentially.
Yeah, understood.
Yeah, so here's the analogy. Imagine that when you have to go to the bathroom, you have to run through a minefield.
I know.
Where would you start going? This is such a tricky one because, as we all know, there are some cats that are highly social, curl up and cuddle with other cats, groom each other, best friends, devastated when their friend leaves. And the fact of the matter is, the cats' social systems is so different than dogs, and it's very different than ours. It's very different than most primates as well. The general traditional social system of the wild-type progenitor of our house cats, the African wild cat, is to have two territories that are proximal and sometimes overlapping but are never used simultaneously. So what your cats have done, basically they have done the best they can to deal with the difficult situation and to live in separate territories. So as long as the female is not making incursions into his territory and attacking him, unless he tries to go into her territory to use a better litter box, regrettably, my best answer to you, to please do not turn off your radio, is to just figure out a way to give him litter boxes in places where he can use them. The one thing that you could try, however, is feel away that pheromone. You can't smell it, won't have any effect on you. And this feel away has been successful in litter box problems related to social angst with cats who are scent marking a lot because of territorial issues. Now, he's not the problem. She's the problem. So you're going to have to choose where to put this. I don't want him feeling more comfortable and therefore deciding that, oh, fine, I'll go over there and get beaten up. You know?
Needs to go in her territory.
If you're going to concentrate it anywhere, you should concentrate it in her territory. But while you're doing that, there's just no way around it. You need to create a litter box system for him in his territory.
Good luck, Matthew. Thanks very much.
It's a tricky, blended cat families.
Very, very tricky issue. You know, we received an email from a listener named Amanda in La Crosse, Wisconsin, Patricia, and she's been looking at getting a young Wheaton Terrier from the local Humane Societies. I want to bring this up with you. Many of the terriers at the Humane Society were given up because they were aggressive, frankly, to other dogs. They were not, however, aggressive toward people. And Amanda does not have any other dogs, but she may have some grand dogs someday.
Mm-hmm.
So she has three questions for you. Is it possible to train aggressiveness out of a dog? If so, how do you start? And third, would you recommend adopting a dog that has aggression issues if you were sure that the owner may have both dogs and children visiting in the future?
Well, I'm happy to answer those questions as long as we have approximately at least 3.5 hours to talk. There's a lot of questions there, and all I can do is answer them with abstracts, chapter titles. One, is it possible to, quote, train aggressiveness out of a dog? Hey, there are some cases indeed where you really can change an animal's behavior. Sometimes you can actually cure it. depending on what the problem is. Say it's fear-based, for example. Say a dog is aggressive to unfamiliar dogs because he's afraid of them. You can go through a counter-conditioning and an operant conditioning paradigm. I've done this a lot with quite a few clients. It's a very common problem. And, you know, some of those dogs, you can completely turn them around so they become like the star of the dog park. There are other dogs, however, that you can change their behavior enough that you can manage it. Maybe you could never take that dog to the dog park, but you're fine walking down the street. Your dog sees another dog. He's fine in the vet clinic, for example. So that's also a common result. There are some dogs, just like you can compare it to a medical problem, really, in that sometimes you can cure the medical problem. Sometimes you have to manage them. And, you know, sometimes there just doesn't seem to be anything anybody can do. So I would need way more information. If there's a specific dog out there, a specific Wheaton, what you need to know is a lot about the dog's history. Was it well socialized with other dogs? If possible, what was the behavior of its parents? You may not be able to get that in a shelter. So the answer is maybe. And then what was the second question, Larry? I need reminding.
Well, how do you start? And then would you recommend adopting a dog that has aggression issues if you're sure you're going to have dogs and kids visiting in the future?
Answer to question number three, no. Moving along to question number two. That was pretty short and not very sweet, but no. There's so many sweet, wonderful dogs out there. Even if you got a dog who was, say, great with kids but aggressive to other dogs, but you knew you were going to want to get other dogs later, you knew you wanted to be able to out and about, and you knew you were going to have a busy life, do you really want to take on a big project? It's a lot to do. It's a lot to do. So the quick answer to number three is no. How do you start working a dog with a dog who has aggression issues is the most important thing that I can tell you, and I'll just get you started. Number one, prevention, prevention, prevention. What you need to do is you need to first create a management plan where you prevent incidents, because barking and lunging, growling, fighting, it's a habit like every other habit, and you need to stop that habit and start teaching the dog an inappropriate or an incompatible behavior along with doing some counter conditioning. So number one is a management plan where you prevent the problems. The next thing to do is get a coach. Find somebody to help you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, nothing will prevent me from getting another caller online.
Oh, you're good. This is why you get the big bucks, Mueller. Nice segue.
Let me give the number 1-800-462-7413 and let me get our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Ann, and I'm from Black River Falls, Wisconsin. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Ann. What can we do for you?
Well, we have an 8-month-old cat that we adopted in December. And about a month ago, we transitioned his litter box to the basement because we have small children. And so we got a cat flap to go downstairs, and he does not use the cat flap. So right now, the solution is we just sort of have it Velcroed up so that he can go downstairs, but it's not ideal. So we cannot get our little Alba to use his cat flap.
And there's probably a good reason for it,
yeah,
Patricia.
Well, you know, the whole concept of going through something that looks solid and pushing through it with your head, you know, it's something that sort of a pushy animal. I mean, we've all had animals who this wouldn't faze in the least, right? They try to go through screen doors and glass walls. But there are other individuals, that's just not who they are. You know, this is very much related, I think, to temperament. So my first question, actually, before I answer your question, is why do you need a cat flap?
Well, we have a 1-year-old. And she was just into the litter box. She thought it was really cool. She loves, you know, sandboxes and stuff like that. And it was just like this little mini sandbox in the house.
Ooh.
Here's a couple of suggestions. One is, one thing you might want to consider, maybe you've already thought about this, but given that life is short and you have a 1-year-old, so life is really short, or the days are long, life is short and the days are long, you have a lot to do, right? So I want to create a plan for you that involves the least possible work on your part. What if you had a couple of child gates that had a little hole cut in them that only your cat could get through? And so you had an area of the house that, for example, I have a downstairs bathroom, and one door is open to it, but there's a child gate, and I cut a little hole with clippers in the bottom that the cat can go through, but the dogs can't. And then the other side, I just keep that door shut. So whenever I need to use that bathroom, I just open the door and shut it. So my cat can go in and out, but my dogs can't help themselves to the cat litter buffet, which, as we all know, is mm-hmm. a prized food.
Oh, yeah.
For dogs, as well as probably one-year-olds, yeah. at least playing in the, like a sandbox, right? So one of the reasons I suggest you considering that alternative is that lots of cats don't like to go a long way away to go to the bathroom. And in this case, being anthropomorphic is actually helpful.
Uh-huh.
What makes a home more valuable? Ask any realtor. If you have a floor that has no bathroom on it, your home has just lost many, many, many thousands of dollars worth of value because people don't like to have to go upstairs or downstairs to go to the bathroom. They want to be able to go to the bathroom on the same floor. You know what? In my experience, so do cats. So some young cats are like fine going down to the basement, but I know an awful lot of cats, especially as they get older, it's like, oh, it's just too much trouble. I'm just going to start going up here. And I don't want you having a serious urination problem with your home, along with having a one-year-old. You got enough to deal with.
No.
So go back, talk to your family, look at your house again with a whole fresh perspective and see, is there a way we could gate off, I don't know, the laundry room? I have a gate that you can easily open and shut, but your one-year-old can't.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can put a little hole in it that the cat can go in and out of. So I would consider that option before I'd worry about the cat flap.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And thanks for all of the callers and all of the emailers. We've had some great email pet tips and everything else this week.
Oh, we have some great listeners. Keep it up.
Keep it up. And we'll look forward to visiting with you again next week. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1013-P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.